This episode is sponsored by Lawrence B. Keller of Physician Financial Services. Larry has been dealing with disability insurance and term life insurance for physicians and other healthcare professionals since 1990. In many cases, Larry has access to guaranteed standard issue disability insurance policies for medical residents and fellows that does not require medical underwriting. To learn more or to have your existing policies reviewed, feel free to reach out to Larry at 516-677-6211, by email to lkeller@physicianfinancialservices.com, or visit www.physicianfinancialservices.com. While he might not be a doctor's first phone call regarding their insurance needs, he is often their last. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to yet another episode of the Nail It Ortho podcast. My name is Dr. Cole. Myself and Dr. Fitz started this podcast to go over high-yield orthopedic surgery topics, but you're actually now tuned into our finance series. A lot of you guys have enjoyed this and have given us good feedback on it, so we're going to continue doing it. In this episode, we're going to talk about tax deductions. We're going to talk about taxes, and if nobody has any idea what we're talking about, we're going to try to like really break it all the way down from the beginner stage. We're going to talk about what taxes are, what taxable income is, what the alternative minimum tax is, some ways to decrease tax deductions, and we're going to talk a lot about a lot of different things taxes wise. And who we have to speak with us today is we have Cecil Statton. He is actually a certified financial planner. He is actually the president and wealth advisor of Arch Financial Planning LLC. This company specializes in early career dentists and physicians with student loans and diligent savers within 10 years of retirement. He knows what he's talking about, to say the least. He did a great job on this episode. We really talked about a lot. And if you want to learn something and take notes, definitely do that, because, again, this is a great episode. So without further ado, let's go ahead and hop into today's episode.
You are now listening to Nailed It, the Orthopedic Surgery Podcast, featuring Drs. Jay Fitz and Wendell Cole.
Cecil, welcome to the Nailed It Ortho podcast. So happy to have you on. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah. And today we're going to talk on something, like a topic that a lot of people are interested in, or at least a lot of people should be interested in, tax deductions, or how to kind of save you money. But just kind of give you a little background on yourself, kind of what got you into this field of like finance and like, you know, taxes, et cetera.
Yeah. So I became a financial planner really for a couple of big picture reasons. One, this is a really great profession for you to be able to actually help and work with people, individuals. Corporate finance, you're often dealing with trying to help maximize profits for a corporation, but with personal finance, you get to actually deal with people and their specific issues. So really that's what drove me to it initially. After that, there's just a lot of great things you can learn that are very practical to not only your own life, but you can help others apply that as well. So from a practicality standpoint, this is one of the professions that just stood out to me. So I've been a financial planner here for my entire career. I'm a certified financial planner and certified student loan professional. Have my own practice called Arch Financial Planning, and I specialize and mostly millennial and just young doctors, most of which will either have student loans or, really early in their career.
Yeah, and that's the majority of our listeners. So those that are listening, this is tailored to you. And then I guess we can kind of just go ahead and jump into it. And what we'll try to do is we'll try to break this down, the basic concepts, and then we'll go a little bit more further into detail, but just kind of give it a basis. Like, can you just give us an overview on what total taxes are and what they consist of?
Yeah, so there's really a handful of buckets that you need to be thinking about with your own tax liability. The first two are generally what most people think about, and that's a federal and state income tax. So when you earn income and you don't have anything to offset that income, which we can talk about later, you will have to pay tax on that. And most states have their own state income tax calculation on top of what you already have to pay for the federal government. Another big one that a lot of people see for the first time on their paycheck when they become a resident, or if they haven't just had a real job before that, is they'll see just employment taxes. So Social Security and Medicare, also called FICA taxes. So those are another big one. that will show up on your pay stub and other ways that you may have to pay those as well if you're a locum doctor or a private practice owner. So those are probably the big ones that we'll dive into today.
Okay. So we have state tax, federal tax, and then this FICA tax that kind of has to deal with a little bit of Social Security. And so what is the marginal tax rate? You know, these are, I was reading a finance book and they're kind of breaking it down by these definitions, like, oh, okay, yeah, that makes sense. So what is the marginal, the marginal tax rate?
So the marginal tax rate essentially just means that you're only paying whatever tax bracket you're in on your next marginal dollar earned. So think about it this way. If you're looking at your tax return and saying, well, gosh, I'm in the 32% tax bracket. All of my income is taxed at 32% on the federal level. Well, that's not really how that works. So you're going to have incremental increases as you earn more income. We're a progressive tax system. So the more you earn, the more you pay, but it's not a cliff. So you may start out in the 10% and the 12% bracket, but work your way up into the 30s. So those numbers, just so you know, are more on like ordinary income, otherwise known as salary you might draw from like a job, but it's not taxed $1. Or once you jump into one bracket, you're not taxed at all those dollars on that specific rate. So that's generally how that works.
All right. So for example, like the first, these are just numbers off the top of my head are no way correct at all. But say this is just for example purposes. But for example, the first 0 to 20,000 maybe taxed at 5%. And then from 20,000 to 50,000, maybe taxed at 10% and so on and so on these different brackets. So you're not paying 30% taxes on all of your money. That's correct.
Exactly. Yeah. And you can really even boil it down to even further by thinking about it from what is your effective rate, right? So your effective rate is probably going to be much lower. In other words, let's say you made $100,000, but you only pay $10,000 in tax, your effective rate may be 10%, but you could be in a 22% marginal bracket, if that makes sense.
Yep.
So those are just some ways to think about it as well.
And then, so when we continue on, you know, you hear this term called taxable income. What exactly is that? Because I didn't even know there was income that's not taxable. I thought everything that you, I thought all income was taxable.
Well, when you're filing your tax return, you have to report, at least in the U.S., you have to report your worldwide earned income. But just because it is earned, there's a couple things that we can talk about real quick just on taxable income, right? So taxable income is really, when you're looking at your tax return, that's what you're actually paying tax on. But there are several deductions and things along the way as well that we'll get into. So just because you earned, let's say, $50,000 or $60,000 as a resident, doesn't mean your taxable income is going to be that high, because you may have deductions and things like that that subtract from what you have to pay tax on. The other thing that you may be alluding to as well is that sometimes your income, even though you have to report it, may not be taxable at all. And generally, the most common thing people hear about that is something called a municipal bond interest. We probably won't spend too much time on that today, I would imagine. But anyways, that's just kind of broad strokes what that looks like.
No, okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Municipal interest. I'm definitely going to write that down. And so another thing that I saw was they were talking about the alternative minimum tax. Is that just mean, like, for example, if you have so much deductions, like there's still a certain amount of tax that you have to pay no matter what, like this is what that is? Or maybe you can explain it in a better way than I can, but what is that?
Yeah, so the alternative minimum tax is something that is not as prevalent as it once was, just because of recent tax law changes, which there have been many of. But essentially what it is what you alluded to. There are certain items that they add back if you have too much as far as deductions go. So in the past, some big ones have been stock compensation. So for many physicians, this is not necessarily an issue, but if your spouse works in tech, particularly early stage startup, they may have stock compensation that could be subject to it, something like that. Essentially, though, what they're trying to do is make sure you don't have too much deduction and that you are paying a floor as far as your tax rate goes. But many people today do, as the tax law stands, at least right now in 2023, it is not as much of an issue as it once was. Of course, that could change.
Okay, cool. Cool. Yeah. So we've kind of discussed overall general what taxes are. You talked about the state, federal, and FICA taxes. You talked about the marginal tax rate, which is the tax rate on your last dollar tax. And we talked about taxable income. Now, all these taxes, what are some ways to decrease? I guess we could start with employment taxes. So, you know, if you're employed by whatever, what are some ways to decrease those taxes? That way you're not, I guess, you know, paying so much.
Yeah, great question. So the high level answer is a tax deduction. And we'll talk about what a few of those are. The one thing I wanted to highlight before we dive into some of those, mm-hmm. though, is when you're talking about ways to lower your taxes, you need to be thinking constantly about ways that you can tax plan or tax planning. So in other words, since we're recording this in the middle of tax season, you shouldn't be going to your CPA or your enrolled agent or whoever's preparing your return and saying, hey, how do I lower last year's taxes? You should be doing it in, let's just say, now in the middle of this year versus waiting until it's too late. So being proactive, like you said. So a couple of ways to do that really just depends on, you know, where you are in your stage of life as far as are you a resident, are you an attending, or things like that. So we can talk about some high level ones. The first easy low hanging fruit ones are going to be typically if you're employed by, let's say, like a hospital system that a lot of residents and maybe some attending positions would be, you can take advantage of a 401k, a 403b plan. You might want to do that anyways, just because of taking advantage of your employer's match that they may or may not offer. Sometimes your employer may match. If you put in, like, let's just say 6%, they may also put in 6%. Some aren't necessarily that generous, but that's just an example. The next low-hanging fruit, so to speak, is what's called a health savings account. If you're young physician that's healthy and you are taking advantage of a high deductible health plan, you can invest in what's called a health savings account. We can talk more about that, but essentially it's an account where you put money in, get a tax deduction now. You can invest that money for the future, or if you don't invest it for the future, you could also use it for healthcare expenses, which is not necessarily limited to just going to see the doctor. So those are some of the more low-hanging fruit ways to really lower your taxes.
Okay, so just to do a little recap, you talked about the 401k and then the 403b, which you can contribute to. And this, so like say, Sarah, for example, you made $46,000 one year and you contribute $1,000 to your 401k. Now you're not getting taxed on $46,000, you're only getting taxed on $45,000. That's correct?
Yeah, that's correct. It's just worth noting there's more to the tax calculation than that. So we can dive into that.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. So, you know, if it's helpful, I mean, why don't we start, since you've got a lot of med students, if we get some MS4s in the crowd here, I did want to mention a few things for them. So if you're an MS4 listening, that is one big thing you can do for your student loan repayment strategy, which is also a tax strategy, is a lot of you as MS4s probably don't have taxable income. And so you may be told, well, I don't need to file a tax return. So what you can do is file a tax return submitting that you have zero income. Well, you do that because when you actually go to sign up for an income-driven repayment plan for your student loan, your income-driven repayment plan calculation would be based on a $0 tax return versus the pay stub that you would have to submit for your income-driven payment calculation. So that's like, if you're an MS4 and you're hearing this around tax time, you just know that's big action item number one I would take if I were you.
Yeah, perfect. So for our fourth year students, just like you said, files MS4, because you're filing zero, and then if you want to repay your loans, you're going to go off that number. So what about, I guess, for our residents / fellows?
Yeah, so when we're kind of transitioning in that career after we've filed that tax return, I did want to just drop that, and you may cover this in other podcast episodes, make sure you get an own occupation disability coverage policy as well. The other thing that you need to look out for as an MS4, just before transitioning, is something called the Kitty tax. So a lot of MS4s, or not even necessarily MS4s, probably more like MS1s and 2s, you might be under the age of 24. And if you are and your parents or grandparents give you stock and you sell it, you would have to pay tax at their rate. So that's just another thing to look out for if you've got some early medical students listening here. So, but once you're transitioning to a resident, really what you need to be thinking about, and I'm sure you can attest to this, is tax savings can be good, but at the same time, like, you're making the lowest amount of money that presumably you will make in your entire career. So a lot of times tax savings really isn't the name of the game. What you might want to be thinking about if you're in that situation is look for your employer's employee benefits. So whatever hospital system you might be at, they may match either your 403B or your 401k or whatever type plan they've got there. You want to capture that match if you can afford to, because that's essentially free income that you can use to start investing. That's one way to lower your taxes. Another way to lower your taxes that can also save for your future is the HSA plan. So if you think about kind of like order of operation, I would start with the 401k or 403B match, then look at your health savings or HSA account contribution as well. If you're still able to save after that, I mean, kudos to you, because we all know that as a resident, like, it's challenging to get through that part. So if you're able to save beyond that, great. Look for the Roth IRA. That would be number three. Now, you may be saying, if you have a little bit of a tax knowledge, Roth IRA contributions don't really save you money in taxes immediately. But what they do is, when you open the Roth IRA, put money in it and invest it, your investments can grow tax deferred or tax free if they're pulled out for qualified expenses. And you won't pay income on interest and dividends along the way as well. So those are really the big picture things as a resident. The other thing, not necessarily tax related, just want to throw that in there, is make sure you get term life insurance. I don't sell it. I just wanted to make that clear. So I'm not like saying call me for that, but you should get some. I can't help you actually get it. I can tell you can do it. But anyways, yeah, those are the big things I'd be thinking about if you're a resident. Also, go listen to Andrew Paulson's episode on student loan planning. Those are the biggies. That would be the order of operations for me.
Yeah. So to recap, when you are an MS4, again, file then, and then also get disability insurance. Can you get any type of a deduction from disability insurance?
No, not while you're a resident or an intending. There are some deductions you could take, but as like a locums or like self-employed type person, but honestly, you probably don't want to, because if you were to file a disability claim and you were to take a deduction against paying those premiums, then your disability benefits would be taxable. If you don't take a deduction, then your disability benefits would be tax-free. So
yeah,
probably not worth taking the deduction in that case. It's one of those things where it's like somewhat counterintuitive. It's actually not worth getting the tax savings in that aspect usually.
Ah, so, okay.
Yeah.
And so then when you're a resident, some of the things you want to look at are a 401k or 403B, in which sometimes the employer will match whatever you put down. Sometimes, hopefully, that'd be nice. Yeah. And then also after that would be a health savings account, which you can put money in that. And you can, I think, you maybe use that money to invest or for any health problems or anything later down the line.
Yeah, just a quick note on the HSA. You mm-hmm. have to be enrolled in a high deductible health plan for the tax year that you're making that contribution. So it's just a big caveat there.
Ah, okay. A high deductible health plan. Mm-hmm. And then
like a PPO or something. Yep.
Ah, okay. Okay. And then lastly, we talked about the Roth IRA, which isn't necessarily going to save you taxes this year. I know, because I was doing TurboTax last year and I was putting in all the money I invested in my Roth IRA, and the little number didn't move at all. Yeah. I was like, oh, okay, you don't save any money off of this. But just like you said, down the line, you know, if you use those funds for investments or things of that sort later on, that can be, you can withdraw that without having to pay taxes on that. So that's the benefit for that, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And you did the right thing by trying to keep track of that. I encourage everybody to do that. So let's just say you are in a tough situation and you need the money. If you've tracked how much money you've put into a Roth IRA, you can pull contribution out at any time. So that's just one, you know, think of that as like the worst case emergency fund, if you will. Like you, it's usually a good idea to try and have some cash on hand, but if you have to go to the Roth IRA, like it is what it is, right? So the IRS is not going to penalize you for taking that money out if you can prove that you made the contributions along the way.
Okay. And
it's just
so
earnings that they tax. Sorry.
It's just the earnings that they tax.
Yeah, that's right.
So if you put in, let's use an example. So say I put in 10,000 into a Roth IRA, but it somehow gained another, let's say 8,000. That 8,000 that it gained, that I can't really take that out, but I can still take out my original 10,000 that I put in.
Yeah, that's correct. And they assume that contributions come out first. That's the way that the order of operations works there. And there are a few reasons you could pull the earnings out, like first home purchase, sometimes educational expenses. There are a few others that don't come up that often. But just generally speaking, that's when it can and could come out. Yeah.
So what about now, you know, we talked a little bit about residency. Now what about for when we're transitioning to like fellowship / early attending life? What are some of the deductions that you can use then?
Yeah. So if you're an attending working in like a hospital system and you're going for PSLF, the name of the game here is going to be trying to lower your income as much as possible, just because when you lower your income, your student loan payments will probably be lower. I mean, there's some caveats where it may not matter, but we'll just talk through some of those ways to do it. So, you know, thinking back to that order of operations again, we would want to go through those first few steps where we talked about getting the 401k or 403b match, HSA, then Roth IRA. That's pretty much like similar, but slightly different. So we'll just go into that. So you would want to max out 403b, 401k, whatever you have there. You would want to max out HSA if you're in a high deductible plan. Typically, when you're an attending physician, your income actually makes it where you are no longer eligible to contribute to a Roth IRA. So you have to utilize a series of steps, typically referred to as the backdoor Roth IRA, which we can talk about if that's helpful. But it's essentially just a series of steps that the IRS more or less requires you to take in order to contribute to that account. So what you essentially must do in that scenario is first contribute to an IRA. If we're doing the backdoor Roth IRA, you have to first contribute to an IRA. Once those funds have settled in the account for a day, you can then convert them to a Roth IRA. Now, don't ask me why you have to go through those steps. It is frankly shenanigans that they make you have to do that, but it is something you have to do. So there's a few things you need to keep in mind if we're going to go through the backdoor Roth IRA step. One, when you're filing your tax return, either you personally doing TurboTax or your CPA or enrolled agent must know that you did this, because it will have to be reported correctly. They have to file a form 8606 or sometimes just referred to as the 8606, more, you know, jargon there. That's the name of the form. So you have to file that. You're also going to get what's called a 1099 from the custodian that you did it. So let's say you use Vanguard, Charles Schwab, Fidelity, one of those. They're going to issue you what's called a 1099, which just essentially states that you did this transaction. In most cases, if you're issued a 1099, it is taxable. However, when you file your form 8606 or 8606, you're telling the IRS that you made what's called a non-deductible contribution to an IRA. So with all that being said, if you go through those steps, it shouldn't cause a taxable event. There is one more caveat that I'll mention, and then we can just see if there's any clarifying points there, but you have to check out something called the pro rata rule. And what that means is, if you already have money inside of an IRA, you may not be the best candidate for the backdoor Roth. And here's why. If you make a non-deductible contribution to an IRA, there's money already in there, and then you convert it, you're going to have a percentage of that conversion taxed. So essentially, you're just creating more taxable income. If you're an attending physician, you're probably in a really high tax bracket, especially for your audience in the ortho specialization. So what that would mean, I guess, in that scenario is that you probably wouldn't be a good fit for it. The last thing I'll say, and then we can jump to any sort of clarifying points on this, is a way to get alleviate that is to simply transfer your IRA to your 401k or your 403b if the plan allows it. So then you would then be allowed to do or able to do the backdoor Roth IRA without having a lot of tax. So I just threw a lot at you there. Anything we can clarify on that?
Yeah, sure. Well, let's start with the backdoor Roth IRA. So traditional Roth, I mean, for the Roth IRA, we're putting money into it because later on the line, we can take it out and not get taxed. So for a backdoor Roth IRA, when we contribute to that, this isn't a tax deduction, like for that year, for example, but this is still overall, you're moving money from different accounts, but this is still just, we're putting it into account. So then later on down the line, we can take that out without paying taxes on whatever you contributed to it. And that's the reason to do a backdoor Roth IRA is because once you make over a certain amount of income, you won't be able to do it with just the Roth IRA. Did I get that?
Exactly.
All right.
You nailed it.
okay.
So yeah, recap. It's you're not saving taxes now. It's just an investment vehicle that you want to max out over long periods of time. It's just a great way to accumulate wealth.
And what's the spending, like the earning limit to where you have to undergo the back door? Is there like a certain dollar amount? If you make this much, then you can't contribute to your Roth IRA?
Yeah. So it's one of those numbers where it changes annually, and it's not a cliff. So it phases you in and out. So for a single borrower in 2023, you are phased out of your modified adjusted gross income, which we can talk about what that is, but I will be on a nice monologue for what that means. But for all intents and purposes, think of your income less your 401k contribution and any other high level deductions like that. For a single person, it's between $138,000 and $153,000 of income where you're phased out. So you can still contribute to a Roth IRA a little bit in that category, but it slowly goes down. For a married couple that files their tax return jointly, it is between $218,000 and $228,000. So $218,000 and $228,000 for 2023.
So for most orthopedists, and I think we have some PAs and things that listen to this as well, it's going to be mostly junior residency / fellowship years. Once you get to like attending level, you probably won't qualify for that.
Yeah. So once you hit that attending level, you're going to, if you want to save in the Roth IRA, which you should in most circumstances, that you're going to have to take those steps.
Okay. And a couple of things I want to get into, but I guess one thing really quickly is I know there's an IRA, at least I was reading. So if you're, I guess this is now more if you're at the attending level and maybe you do some type of self-employment, you know, maybe you have an LLC or you partnered with some other people and y'all have an LLC together and that you consult or whatever. What are some ways to decrease self-employment taxes and, you know, that you may see commonly in the physician or the PA or whatever it may be?
Yeah. So it's a great, great question there. So when you're thinking about being, let's say like a locums or like you're like an attending or you're in a private practice or something like that, what you need to start making sure that you're doing is keeping track of expenses, particularly expenses with a business use. So let's just say you're independent contractor locums. You might be buying a computer. You might be buying an iPad, mileage for travel, things like that. You can use all of these to deduct against your income and pay less tax. So you know, if you're locum as well, some other examples might be cost of health and dental premiums, use of a cell phone, lab coats. When you're buying all these things, you need to track them. In an ideal world, you might be using something like QuickBooks or just name any accounting software that you want to use. But you need to keep receipts and track these. Luckily, most of these you can link your bank account or your credit card and it will pull in transactions to help you keep track of that better. But those are some of the high level ways to do that. Beyond that, you want to look into depreciation of business assets. So let's say you bought that computer, for example, or some other piece of equipment that may have cost a large sum of money. The government allows you for large equipment purchases right now to accelerate the depreciation. So in other words, for some of those large purchases, they may not let you write off the whole expense in the first year, but if you use what's called accelerated or and bonus depreciation, you may be able to write off more of that in the first year. So just know that there are some tax law changes that's making that a little bit more tricky in terms of how those percentages work and how those calculations work, but keeping track of depreciation of those expenses. Another big way is to make your tax election for your entity. So when you are a locums or private practice, you may have an LLC. If you don't, it's just kind of common practice to think about setting one of those up. So when you're a high income person that owns an LLC, and that's how your income flows through to you on your tax return, you might make what's called an S-Corp tax election. What that essentially means is you're going to tell the federal government that you want to be taxed as a corporation, even though you are an individual. So if you're an individual without this election, you use a form called Schedule C. If you use, if you make the tax election of an S corporation, you use what's called an 1120S. Just note that if you make an S corp election, it can be a great thing for a couple of reasons. One, you can save on employment taxes such as Social Security and Medicare, but it comes at a cost because you are adding a lot more complexity to your tax return. So a lot of times, if you're in a physician who is in that, you know, should I make an S election on my tax return? I highly recommend bringing in a CPA or an enrolled agent at this point. The last like fine detail there is when you're just a Schedule C or just a solo practitioner, so to speak, all income is income. It doesn't necessarily have the distinction of salary versus an ownership dividend. When you make an S corp election, you have to make a reasonable salary to yourself. And then the remaining amount that you have, so let's say your net income is $300,000, just for example, you may have to pay yourself $120,000, $150,000 salary. And then the remaining can come out as a dividend, which is where you get some of that savings on maybe the self-employment taxes that are Social Security and Medicare. So, or FICA taxes is another word for those. So, and then the last big one there is using retirement plans. So if you're a solo person, just like locum tenens, the solo 401k is usually my favorite retirement account to start at. I generally prefer that one over the SEP IRA. There's a couple use cases for the SEP IRA, but generally speaking, the solo 401k, in my opinion, gives a little bit more flexibility because with a SEP IRA, that pro rata rule that we mentioned on the backdoor Roth IRA, that becomes a concern with the SEP IRA. You don't have to worry about that with the solo 401k. You could also add features such as a profit sharing plan or a cash balance plan. For all intents and purposes, those are just features that, and the cash balance plan is actually a whole separate plan, but those are just features to defer even more income. So those are really the big picture items I would be looking at. So just to recap here, track your expenses, look into depreciation, should you consider an S election, retirement plan. Oh, one last one. A lot of, or sometimes in smaller practices, folks like to hire their spouse. So you have a spouse that has some legitimate work in the practice that you're running. It can be something as simple as bookkeeping or marketing or whatever, just any administrative thing. You may be able to take some deductions there. They would be able to have retirement account contributions as well, such as that 401k account that we talked about, or profit sharing or cash balance plan. So those are the high level ones.
Okay. All right. Yeah. No, that makes sense. And remind me one more time, the pro rata rule. What, I know we talked about it when we were talking about the backdoor Roth IRA, but what is that pro rata rule one more time, just as a reminder?
Yeah, just at a really high level, if you have an IRA balance, so let's say you were a resident at a hospital and you took that 401k and you rolled it over to an IRA. Well, now when you make that backdoor Roth IRA contribution, you have to think about that balance, because essentially what it means is when you do the backdoor Roth IRA and you have an IRA balance, a portion of your conversion from the IRA to the Roth when you're doing the backdoor Roth IRA is now going to be taxable. So let's just say, for example, you make a $6,000, contribution, or I guess in this year, you can make a $6,500 contribution for 2023. And you have a $100,000 IRA, you're going to have a very high portion of that conversion amount taxed.
Okay. No, yeah, no, that makes sense. Okay. So we talked about ways, if you're doing a self-employment way, to decrease some of your taxes. Now, I guess just for more general purposes, what are the difference between, I guess, when you're actually filing these standardized versus itemized deductions? Because for people like me, we go through TurboTax, and whichever one it says is less, you just click that button. But I have no idea what one versus the other means.
Yeah, so the standard deduction is something that's been around for a long time. And essentially what it means is the IRS is going to give you a freebie. They're going to say, if you're an individual or married couple, depending on what that situation is, they're going to let you just take some deduction straight off your tax return. So for a single individual in 2023, the standard deduction is $13,850. For a married couple filing jointly, it's $27,700. So let's say, for example, you made $100,000 and you're married. The IRS just says, hey, you know what? You made $27,700 less. It's pretty straightforward. Itemizing your deductions, on the other hand, though, adds another tax calculation onto your return on a form called Schedule A. And it's not as straightforward, but some of the big, as I'm going to make it sound right now, but some of the big expenses that you can put on there are medical expenses. So there is a big caveat there, but if you have really high medical expenses in a particular year, for most people in your audience, you probably aren't going to get to this unless something really, really bad has happened to you, or you have to pay for having a child. That's usually the only times I see this for medical expenses. So they do let you deduct some medical expenses, but it's really hard to get to the point where you qualify for that. The next thing that they let you add on to itemizing deductions is property and real estate taxes and state income taxes as well. Right now in 2023, again, those tax laws may or may not change in a couple of years, but you are limited to $10,000 of that. If you're a resident, you may say, well, I'm never going to pay that much. But if you're an attending and you're listening to this and you bought a house and you're making a nice salary, you're blowing way past that. And so that's on there as well. There's also mortgage interest and a few other miscellaneous items that probably aren't necessarily worth going into right now. Mm-hmm. But once you add all of those expenses up, if you have more of those expenses than the standard deduction, then you would take the itemized deduction. So you're, in other words, itemizing what you did. Oh, sorry, the last big one is charity. There's some interesting nuance to charity as well, unless you're giving cash. So for many people, the rate is like 90%+ of people today, as it stands, take the standard deduction. You really have to have a lot of state income tax or mortgage interest, charity, things like that, or big medical expenses to actually itemize. The majority of the country right now does not.
Okay. No, that makes sense. Versus when we talk about standard versus the itemized, and you touched on things like, you know, you're able to kind of like write out some of those property taxes if you own a house and a mortgage interest that you pay on. Also some charity contributions that you talked about as well. Now, I think one term we mentioned a little bit earlier that maybe we can dive into is the qualified business income reduction. What is that? I saw it on a couple of different sites, and all the sites just said this is what it is, but nothing really explained it. So I'm still a little confused, but what exactly is qualified business income reduction? And then I guess, how does that work?
Yeah, great. So it's literally on my list for what we should have talked about under like locum tenens or practice center. So I'm very glad you brought it up. So essentially the qualified business income deduction, or QBI, is something that was created a couple of years ago out of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act back in 2017. And essentially what that does is say for business owners who have business income, you get to take a deduction on that. Now, what I hope I just said makes it sound really simple, but it's actually a very complex calculation, especially for physicians in this audience. So let's say you're a locums doctor or a private practice physician, and you get either like a K-1 or which we can talk about in a little bit, or you're just getting income from a business. We'll just keep it simple like that. Anything that isn't salary or something like that gets a deduction, typically around 20%. But for most people, again, it's not that simple. So just think about it like this, right? Your business makes, let's just say you net like $500,000 after all income and expenses. Well, probably a lot of people in your audience at that point may phase out because they look at what's called a specialized trade or business. In other words, if your business is dependent upon your reputation, your service, so a physician, you're going to get phased out of that. But if you're probably on the lower end of that, for like say a married couple of say around $400,000, you probably will get to take a deduction somewhere in the neighborhood of close to 20% of some of that net income. But again, there's more nuance to it.
Yeah. So I guess I'm not seeing why. So like, you know, for example, this is made up, but say, for example, I own a real estate business or something, you know, I work as a physician, and I also, let's say, own a real estate business, and say that business brings in, $50,000 profit. So after expensive and everything, you get $50,000 profit. So you're saying from that, you may be able to deduct, say, for example, 20% from that income. It is just because you have a business, or I guess I'm not seeing what exactly qualifies you for it.
Yeah. So it's just think about it like this. When I say they, I mean the federal government, when they were trying to rewrite the tax code back in 2017, they gave huge tax cuts to corporations. So like, just think big tax corporations that have what's called a C corp. And for most people in your audience, it will most likely never make sense to make a C corp election. So I'm not going to go into that, but they wanted to level the playing field for small business, small practice owners. And so this is a way to do that. So just think about qualified business income as like the net amount of qualified income that you make from your business. So a real estate is another great example that counts for that as well. But think about it this way, right? So you're you're a locums doctor. We'll just use that as an example. You still have a business. Even if it's just you still have a business. So you're not an employee of a hospital. Even if you go work at one, you're just a contractor there. You're not like what's called a statutory W-2 employee. So
right.
what they're trying to do is give anybody that has that business just an extra tax break on that 20% of net income from the business in order to level the playing field compared to other corporations. What I wouldn't overthink is, do you qualify for it? What I would overthink, though, is the calculation to get to what that 20% number is, because that is, they did not make simple.
Okay. That's what I'm going to ask you. I was going to say, is it after a certain amount, like, do you have to make 1,000, 5,000, 10,000 before you get that? Or like, is, or maybe in general, but is there like a range amount before you're able to, you know, it's just like, if I have a business that only made $100 a year, I don't know if I'm going to get that versus maybe 5,000 a year.
You probably won't with $100 per year. And the reason being, or maybe not even 5,000, because a lot of people have some income outside of that. So you probably won't get to take the full 20% deduction on like the $100 or $5,000. But let's say, you know, you're just a locums employee or like, sorry, a locums physician, right? If you're using a Schedule C, which is what is generally the default there, or you're making that S corp election, anything that comes from income from those two sources is qualified business income.
Okay.
So there's a caveat to that. The salary from a S corporation that you may have, that you have to take, that does not count as qualified business income. So that's part of that discussion about whether or not you should be an S corp or not. Usually it probably makes sense to do it, but sometimes it may not. That's why I say bring in a CPA or enrolled agent at that point, because the calculations just are not straightforward. But the other thing you have to look out for too is with qualified business income, they really are targeting specified service trade or businesses. So essentially, a specified trade or business is somebody who has their business that is determined, or the sole source of the income is based on a service or reputation of the owner. So you would automatically qualify for that as a physician, as a financial planner. I automatically qualify for that too. So I bring that up because if your income is phased out for a single filer in the low 220s to 250s, somewhere in that range, I think is like on the top end. For a married couple filing jointly, it's like in the mid 450 range or so. So if you're in that range, you're getting phased out of what you can take on the QBI deduction. So in other words, if you've heard President Biden say they don't want to raise income on people making less than $400,000, that, and for a married couple, that's kind of how they're backing into that a little bit. That phase out can get people in this space.
Okay. And one question I wanted to ask you that just popped back in my mind when you said it from earlier is the assets that drop very quickly, like after you buy them. You mentioned like big, you know, businesses that make some big asset, maybe some big tech or something that depreciate. That's what it is. Is that, you always hear stories about, like, you know, these patients or these people that are doing this got a car and, you know, they got it through the business and they were able to write off the whole car. Is that kind of how that works, since that's a depreciating asset?
Yes. But I'm going to give a big asterisk next to that. So the car, if you're on TikTok or Instagram Reels, you're going to see, frankly, a lot of bad tax advice. I highly encourage you to take a lot of that with a grain of salt. So with a lot of that accelerated bonus depreciation that you might hear about, first of all, they'll say like Section 179, it's actually bonus depreciation that they're supposed to be talking about. So if you go to your, you know, tax advisor, mention bonus depreciation and they'll think you know what you're talking about. But you have to prove business use for the assets that you're depreciating. So if you just drive your G-Wagon, which is the one that they like to talk about, to your office and back, that probably isn't enough for business use. Like if you're driving it to maybe from your office to the hospital or from your home to a conference or something like that, that's business use. But you have to have a business use for it. So for the car specifically, you do that by tracking your mileage. You know, candidly, I mean, if people are out there saying that they're bonus depreciating 100% of their car and writing the whole thing off, they're telling the IRS that they are only using that car for business use and not just taking like a trip to the grocery store, not even doing that. So just be careful with that. Is the big qualifier there.
Okay. And I just have like a couple of quick questions before we wrap up here. Now, one place I was reading was saying that if you, I guess, maybe make payments on your student loan interest, that you could, that maybe those can get, there's like a student loan interest deduction. Can you kind of explain that, or is that a real thing? Like, you know, if I'm paying on, you know, my interest on my student loans, can I go ahead and can I deduct that from my taxes and that counts?
Yes. So it's funny we bring that up because nobody has had to make student loan payments since March 13th of 2020.
Yeah.
So a lot of people, including tax preparers themselves, are not used to having to think about student loan interest or ask for it. So yes, you can deduct student loan interest. There are income phase outs. So most likely by the time you file your first tax return as an attending physician, you will have phased out your income. So in 2023, the phase out for a single individual is between $75,000 and $90,000. And once you hit that $90,001, you can't deduct any. Mm-hmm. For a married couple, it's $155,000 through $185,000. So once you hit that $185,001, you can't deduct any student loan interest. So it's something to make sure when you're a resident to really be thinking about. You know, nobody's had to make student loan payments, or at least not with federal student loans, for the last few years. So it's not been top of mind, but you're great to bring it up.
Yeah. So ideally, you know, I mean, if you have enough money to do this while you're a resident and you're doing, for example, the PLIF, I always get mixed up with acronyms, this the public student loan forgiveness program.
Yeah.
And you're only paying your interest. Theoretically, you could write all that off at the end of the year.
Yeah, just a quick note on the PSLF stuff. Go listen to Andrew's episode with you,
yeah.
But you need to be enrolled in that income-driven repayment plan for those payments to count towards public service loan forgiveness. So if you're going to be ending your career in a nonprofit hospital system, great student loan strategy there.
And last thing I wanted to ask, which I probably should have asked at the beginning because we've thrown the terms around. Should docs or, you know, any medical professionals get professional helps? And if so, who? You know, you mentioned enrolled agents for a while and then CPAs. Like, is there any difference between who can help you with your taxes and the kind of the level of training needed for that?
Yeah. So just big picture, if you're going to hire a tax advisor, you nailed it right there. They need to have one of those credentials. The enrolled agent is one of those credentials that it holds the same level of stature in front of the IRS. So if you need help in front of the IRS, they can also represent you just like a CPA or frankly, a JD, somebody that's a lawyer. So you want them to have at least that. You also want them to have some experience just because they have letters after their name, even the enrolled agent or even the CPA doesn't necessarily mean that they are going to be the best person to prepare your tax return. But for a lot of people, you know, residents and stuff like that, if you are comfortable with it, you could probably, like yourself, use something like TurboTax. If you would like free resources, the IRS has a list of free resources. So I highly recommend at least checking those out. But once you, if you're like the locum's private practice, you're going to buy yourself a lot of free time is the way I would frame it if you hire a CPA or an enrolled agent to prepare your tax return. There are several places you can find them. The Whitefin Investors got a great list. I know a couple of people on there that do a great job. If you would like a recommendation, feel free to reach out. I won't, you know, do anything beyond that. If all you want is a recommendation for a tax preparer, so please reach out. I know plenty good ones. But if you want to just kind of play the field or find somebody local, you could look up find an enrolled agent or find a CPA site. There are plenty of those out there as well.
Awesome. Well, Cecil, I think this has been really helpful. I definitely learned a lot about taxes and deductions and different programs and different things. For those that are listening, how can they follow you if they, you know, if they want to follow you on social media or a website that you have where they can check out some more? I know you mentioned something at the beginning, but, you know, just to kind of give them something if they want to follow you and see what you have going on.
Yeah, absolutely. So my website is archfinancialplanning.com. And if you want to follow along, I send out a roughly monthly newsletter that way, and it's really geared towards early career physicians. So just stuff we need to be thinking about there. I am pretty active on Twitter and LinkedIn and places like that. So if you want to follow any content that I put out, that's typically where it goes out, would be those three main channels. And yeah.
Awesome. Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you. For those that are listening, we hope you all enjoyed it and learned a lot about taxes. I know I did for sure. So I hope that you all enjoyed it. And again, Cecil, thanks for coming on the podcast and being a guest. Did you learn a lot about taxes? Because I know I definitely did. So we hope that you enjoyed this episode. We hope that you learned a lot, and we will continue on with our finance series. We want you to be great doctors clinically with orthopedics, but we also want you to be smart financially as well. So hopefully this can be your one-stop shop for everything. So without further ado, we will see you all next time. Don't forget to hit the subscribe button if you have not, so you get notified anytime we have a new episode. You should do that. You should go and do that right now if you haven't. This episode is sponsored by Lawrence B. Keller of Physician Financial Services. Larry has been dealing with disability insurance and term life insurance for physicians and other healthcare professionals since 1990. In many cases, Larry has access to guaranteed standard issue disability insurance policies for medical residents and fellows that does not require medical underwriting. To learn more or to have your existing policies reviewed, feel free to reach out to Larry at 516-677-6211, by email to lkeller@physicianfinancialservices.com, or visit www.physicianfinancialservices.com. While he might not be a doctor's first phone call regarding their insurance needs, he is often their last.